I just want to point out a few things. I mentioned yesterday that there's a very interesting machlokas in Midrashim, and it reflects itself in a later machlokas between the Ramban and the Sephorno. I don't think I mentioned the Sephorno yesterday. Whether Yaakov initiating contact with Esav was a good idea or a bad idea. Because remember that Yaakov didn't hear it. In other words, Yaakov gets the message that Esav is approaching him only after he sends the gifts to Esav. So the Ramban actually brings the Medrash that it was a very, very big Avera, or at least a mistake, maybe not an Avera, but a big mistake for Yaakov to even initiate contact, because that got Esav jealous and made Esav angry and stirred up bad memories. And the best thing would have been, the Ramban writes, is for Yaakov to simply not even contact Esav at all. And if you remember, I quoted the verse in Mishle that it's like pulling the ears of a sleeping dog. You know, you're just creating problems for yourself. Now, I want to add a little bit to the Ramban, because the Ramban actually gives a historical precedent for this. He actually says, and this is relevant to the Hanukkah story, and maybe next week I'll get into some of the history of Hanukkah, which is very interesting, that you know how the Romans got a foothold into Eretz Yisrael? It's very, very interesting. What happened was that when the Greeks were overthrown in the Hanukkah story, so the Hashmonaim, the Hasmoneans, established a Jewish kingdom. They established a Jewish kingdom, a Jewish state. At some point in the Malchus of the Hashmonaim, there was a civil war between two brothers, two Jewish brothers, each of whom wanted the kingship. Hyrcanus and Aristobulus. They had Greek names, but they were Jews. And one of them invited the Roman army to come in and take sides with them. So they invited the Romans, giving them a foothold in Eretz Yisrael. But of course what happened was, once the Romans came and they brought an army in, they decided not to leave. So the Ramban makes the point that you see that initiating contact and trying to be on their good side can turn around and backfire and really hurt you, and therefore that was Yaakov's mistake. The Sephorno, on the other hand, argues with the Ramban, and the Sephorno actually says it was entirely reasonable that Yaakov is engaging in a preemptive type of bribe so that Esav shouldn't hate him by showing that, you know, you're my master, etc. Again, a little bit of history about, just so you know, Ramban and Sephorno, these are, besides Rashi, these are considered to be two of the greatest Mefarshim. I mean, Rashi is the top. And then under Rashi is Ramban and Sephorno. Ramban lived in the 1200s, and he lived in Spain. He was the generation right after the Ramban, and the Ramban lived in Catholic Spain. The Saporno, his name is Rav Ovadia Saporno, so he has a last name already. The last names were already beginning to be in vogue. He lived in Renaissance Italy. He's the 1500s in Italy, so this was literally during the Renaissance. It's interesting that he had an interesting parnassa. He was a doctor, but he was also a teacher of Hebrew to archbishops and cardinals of the Catholic Church. He kind of made a living by being a Hebrew teacher to the Goyim and the like, but nevertheless, as they say, his parish is considered to be very, very great. But be this as it may, it's an interesting machlokas that the Ramban basically says, vis-a-vis the Goyim, keep away from them. Don't do good with them, don't do bad with them, just stay away. Saporno sees a positive benefit in trying to actively get along in different ways. Now, there's another Chazal that sees something negative in Yaakov's behavior. You will notice that Yaakov refers to himself as Avdecha, your servant Yaakov. I am your servant Yaakov. I am your servant Yaakov. According to Chazal, can we pass the Chumash there? I just want to be sure I have the count right. How many times does he refer to himself as a servant in that speech that he sent to Esau? So let's see. Avdecha is one. Actually, it's not Avdecha, it's Adoni. How many times did he call Esav my master? One, two, he refers to himself as Esav's servant and Esav as his master seven times. If you look at the end of the Parsha, there is a listing of eight kings who ruled in Esav's land, eight Edomite kings, before there was a king in Israel, meaning the Jewish people didn't have a king until Shaul's time. But Esav had kings who were dominant in the lands for seven generations before the Jewish people had a monarchy. Chazal say, because of the seven times that Yaakov called himself a servant of Esav, Esav had seven generations of ascendancy before the Jewish people had their own malchus and the like. So Chazal saw it as something a little bit bad that Yaakov is lowering himself to Esav. In fact, there is another teaching that's connected to this as well. You know that Amalek is related to Esav. How is Amalek related to Esav? Because Amalek had a son, Eliphaz, and Eliphaz took a concubine, not a wife, Timnah, and from the relationship between Eliphaz and Timnah, there was this child, Amalek. And Amalek, as we know, in time, became the source of pure destructive evil, a nation that we are commanded to eradicate because they represent everything that is bad and everything that is corrupt. They are considered to be a symbol of the snake of Gan Eden that introduced hate and evil into the world. But there's an interesting Gemara that says the following. Amalek can only be defeated by the children of Rachel. Amalek cannot be defeated by the children of Leah. This is a Gemara in Bava Basra. In fact, if I remember, I think it's in Cheskes Abatim. You probably will not get there. It's towards the end of Cheskes Abatim. But if you manage to do 25 or 30 blot this month, you will encounter that Gemara. Yeah.
How does that play into what we were talking about yesterday with Benjamin and Dina being switched, or is it Yosef?
Yes, yeah, no, it's Yosef and Dina being switched. Well, still, the way it plays into it is that although Yosef came from Rachel's womb, but he was carried in, I'm sorry, he came from Dina's egg, but he was carried in Rachel's womb, so he's called Rachel's child, not Leah's child, right?
Okay.
Now, let me just show you, let me just trace you, how do we know throughout history that Amalek gets defeated by Rachel's children and not Leah's children? Amalek, you'll recall, was the very first nation that attacked us when we left Mitzrayim. They were the very first, without provocation. Moshe Rabbeinu designated someone to lead the war against Amalek. Anyone remember who that person was? It was none other than Yehoshua ben Nun, who at the time was called Hoshea. This is the first time Yehoshua appears. He is the general that Moshe puts in charge of the war against Amalek. What tribe does Yehoshua ben Nun come from? The tribe of Ephraim. Who is Ephraim's father?
Yosef.
Who is Yosef's mother? Rachel, because that's the womb that from which Yosef emerged. So the first war against Amalek was carried out with the child of Rachel through Ephraim. Now, the second great war was when the Jewish people finally got a king. They got King Saul, Shaul HaMelech. Shaul was commanded to eradicate Amalek. He did not fulfill the mitzvah entirely because he spared the king, and that was a very big sin, and that is why he lost the Malchus. But what tribe is Shaul HaMelech from? Binyamin. Binyamin is the last son of Rachel, Zerah Rachel. That is why David couldn't finish the job. It's interesting. David is from Yehuda, which is from Leah. David was not able to finish the job of eradicating Amalek. It had to be done by Zerah Rachel, not Zerah Leah. Now, we know that when Agag, the king of Amalek, was released, eventually he was killed, but he managed to impregnate a woman in the short time he was escaped. And that woman eventually had a child, and this was the ancestor of Haman. Haman came from that king that Shaul failed to kill. Now we know in the Purim story, it was Mordechai and Esther that orchestrated the destruction of Haman, which is the downfall of Amalek. What tribe is Mordechai and Esther from? Binyamin. They are descendants of Shaul HaMelech. They finished what Shaul didn't finish. Finally, we are told in the Gemara Sukkah that before there will be Mashiach ben David, who will rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, there will be a very enigmatic, mysterious figure that we don't know a lot about, who is called Mashiach ben Yosef, who will be killed in the war of Gog and Magog, the apocalyptic wars. By the way, you know that the term that the Christians like to use, Armageddon, they like to talk about the final. Armageddon is just Greek for Gog and Magog. I don't know exactly how you get it, but Gog and Magog is Armageddon. And this refers to the apocalyptic wars that are going to come before Mashiach. We hope that we already had them, World War II or whatever it would be, but it is possible that the wars of Gog, we haven't seen them yet, that the wars of Gog and Magog are coming, and people talk about nuclear war. In fact, there's a comment of the Vilna Gaon that is so amazing. The Vilna Gaon made this comment 250 years ago, and he said, the war of Gog and Magog, that awful war, will last 12 minutes. Now, 250 years ago, and even 100 years ago, nobody knew what on earth did this sentence even mean. What type of war can last 12 minutes? Unfortunately, and somewhat frighteningly, we now understand the Vilna Gaon's comments much better than his contemporaries understood it, that indeed there can be awful, awful destruction in 10 minutes, 12 minutes, 5 minutes. 12 minutes is pretty long already, But be it as it may, what is the purpose, right? So this Mashiach ben Yosef, what is the purpose? So it is said that Mashiach ben Yosef will be the final eradicator of Amalek, paving the way for Mashiach ben David. Mashiach ben David, who comes from Leah, Shevet Yehuda, cannot eradicate Amalek. You need the Mashiach ben Yosef. Now, the one thing I'm not explaining, because I don't really have an answer, is how come sometimes it's from the Yosef side and sometimes it's from the Binyamin side? That's a good question. But the common denominator is every encounter with Amalek always comes from Rachel's side. It does not come from Leah's side. Right? Starting with Yehoshua bin Nun, and then Shaul HaMelech, and then the Purim story, and then Mashiach ben Yosef before Mashiach ben David. Now, why is that so? What is the secret? So, there are other interpretations we'll talk about more when we get to Purim. We'll talk about this more at length. But I just want to give you a reason that is connected to the Parsha. And it is said that because all of Leah's children bowed down to Esav, they were obsequious. Yaakov called us, we're your servants, we're your slaves. And remember, all of the children bowed down. But there's a tradition that Yosef did not bow down. Yosef protected his mother. Yosef stood up to protect his mother. And Binyamin was not even born yet, because Binyamin is not born until after this whole incident. So it turns out that since all of Yaakov's other children subordinated, bowed down, considered Esav to be their master, then God, Mida Keneged Mida, made Esav, Amalek, their master. And it's only Yosef who refused to bow down, and Binyamin, who was not born yet, that are immune from this because they did not acknowledge Esav as their master. So seen from all of this, there's a certain perspective in which Chazal were a bit critical in retrospect of what you might call the obsequiousness, kind of the subordination that Yaakov is, it's a little too much. You know, why are you lowering yourself to this Russia and the like? But again, you can't really paskin here because Chazal have different views. There are other Chazals that say this was 100% the right thing to do. And I'm sure you all know the famous Chazal that say that Yaakov Avinu did three things before he encounters Esav, and we have to do those three things whenever we encounter Umos HaOlam. One is be willing to send gifts. Lower yourself. Kind of try to make peace. Number two, be ready for war if necessary. Don't be naive. And number three, which is the most important, pray to Hashem that He should help you, because without Hashem's help, plan A is not going to work and plan B is not going to work. So whether you're doing plan A, plan B, or combining plan A and B, you need tefillah. So maybe I shouldn't call it C, maybe I should call it A, but you need tefillah, and that's why Yaakov is doing the strategy. The Gemara says, if you remember right, who is the author of the Mishnah? Everybody knows. The author of the Mishnah is Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. When did he write the Mishnah? Around the year 200. When was the Beis HaMikdash destroyed by the Romans? The year 70. So this was around 130 years after the Chorban. But you have to know that even after the Chorban, there was a major, major revolt by the Jewish people that the Romans crushed mercilessly. And this was the Bar Kokhba revolt. Okay, again, some of this may be obvious to some people may not know it, so I want to be sure you understand this. The Romans destroyed the Beis HaMikdash because the Jews were rebelling against the Romans, and the Chachamim told the Jews not to rebel. The Chachamim warned the people that if you rebel against the Romans, they will destroy the Beis HaMikdash, and life will be very, very bitter. And many rebellious Jews rebelled against the Romans over the objection of Chazal. And everything happened that Chazal said would happen. The Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. Thousands of Jews were murdered. They were sold into slavery. Women were raped. It was awful. But after a while, things did settle down. Meaning after the Chorban, as devastating as it was, Jews were still allowed to teach Torah. They could keep Shabbos. They could keep kosher. They could live in Yerushalayim, although many didn't because it was a destroyed city, so they went up north. Meaning, the Chorban is an awful, awful tragedy. That's why we fast on Tisha B'Av. But life did go on after the Chorban. But then, around the year 130, 60 years after the Churban, the Jews broke out with a tremendous revolt led by a great person whose name was Shimon ben Koziva, but Rabbi Akiva gave him the name Bar Kochba. Bar Kochba means the son of a star. Rabbi Akiva thought Bar Kochba was Mashiach, which is described as a star. There's even some evidence Bar Kochba began to build a third Beis HaMikdash. And Bar Kochba revolted against the Roman Empire. And this was initially a tremendously successful revolt. Bar Kochba captured 900 villages from the Romans. He minted coins. Rabbi Akiva thought he was Mashiach. But eventually what happened was that Hadrian responded with overwhelming brutal force. Now, and this occurred in Beitar, and that's another reason why we fast on the 9th of Av. It's interesting. Now, it's important to understand, therefore, that there are two Roman actions connected with the 9th of Av. One was the destruction of the temple in the year 70. The other was the crushing and destruction of Bar Kochba's army after 5 years of fighting in Beitar on the 9th of Av. And in many, many ways, the aftermath of Beitar was much more brutal than even the aftermath of the Churban Beis HaMikdash. When you read in the Gemara that the Romans didn't allow people to learn Torah, that they took Rabbi Akiva and they combed his flesh with iron combs, and the 10 martyrs who were executed, and the babies that were thrown into the fires, this was not after the Churban Beis HaMikdash. This was after the Bar Kochba revolt. That is when, if you were teaching Torah, the Romans would kill you. So, in many, many ways, the Churban of Beitar, and even in terms of numbers, if you look at the numbers the Gemara gives us, all right, the Mefarshim say they might be Guzmas, but the numbers are millions. Now, maybe it wasn't millions, but the numbers are much, much greater than even the Churban Beis HaMikdash. Yeah.
A rabbi told me the other day that the Romans couldn't, like, touch Bar Kochba because he was such a good fighter. And then God sent, I want to ask you if this is true, this is what he told me. While he was on the toilet, God sent a giant snake which bit him in half. Is this?
Well, this is very interesting. The Gemara in Gittin records that story, and it says that while he was relieving himself, a snake bit him from the intestines inside, and that caused him to die. What's interesting is, it doesn't call him Bar Kochba, it calls him Bar Jeroma, and it's not clear, is this the same guy or somebody else? So it's a very good question. But it's very logical that it's describing Bar Kochba, but it's interesting that for some reason, that is not the name that is used. The name that's used is somebody of whom we don't know anything about. But you are correct, there is such a story. It is possible. Bar Kochba was a tremendously... In fact, it's so interesting. I mean, I don't want to talk about this topic now. I mean, was Rabbi Akiva wrong? Rabbi Akiva was the greatest rabbi of his time and really one of the greatest gedolim we've ever had. Rabbi Akiva thought Bar Kochba was the Mashiach who would redeem Am Yisrael. But Bar Kochba gets killed by the Romans, and not only are the Jewish people not redeemed, but the sorrows that befell Am Yisrael are catastrophic. So what's going on? Did Rabbi Akiva just goof here? So this is a much more complicated issue. The issue basically is that Bar Kochba could have been the Mashiach. Could have been. Now there's every generation there is a Mashiach. Even now there is a Mashiach. Maybe somebody in this room. Who knows? I mean, I'll take myself out of competition, but I don't want to exclude anybody else. Now, the thing is, every generation has a Mashiach. He may not know it. But if the generation is not deserving, it's not going to happen. The person will come and go, and then there'll have to be somebody else. We don't believe in a second coming, per se. That's why, without getting into Chabad politics, when the Rebbe was alive, maybe, yeah. I don't know. Maybe. Somebody went to Rav Moshe Feinstein like in 1975 and said, Rebbe, you have to issue a proclamation. Chabad is saying Lubavitcher Rebbe is Mashiach. So Rav Moshe Feinstein said, what would be so bad if he would be Mashiach? He says, what am I supposed to proclaim against? Maybe he is. once somebody's dead, they're not in the running anymore. That much I think is true. That's why a Jew can't be a Christian, and the like. So Rabbi Akiva was not wrong. Rabbi Akiva correctly assessed that had the Jewish people been meritorious, Bar Kokhba would have been the figure who would have been the Mashiach that could have brought it to a Geula. Unfortunately, we were not worthy, we were not righteous enough, we were not holy enough, and there was a great, great destruction that took place. Yeah.
Didn't Bar Kokhba not agree with Rabbi Akiva? He didn't like the fact that people called him Mashiach?
You know, I'm not aware of that. Do you remember? You remember hearing that? I'm going to check it. I'm going to check it. That would be very interesting. That Bar Kokhba turned down the. What I remember is that when Rabbi Akiva said Bar Kokhba's Mashiach, one of the other rabbis said to him, "Rabbi Akiva, grass is going to grow out of your hand, meaning you'll be in the grave a long time, and Mashiach won't have come yet." But that was one of the rabbis. But I'll see if Bar Kokhba may have said it himself. Now. Why am I bringing all this up? I mean, this was a digression. The reason I'm bringing this up is you have to understand when the Mishnah was written. So now let's focus on this. Was the Mishnah written? The Mishnah is written when the land of Israel is under Roman domination. But are these good times for the Jews or are these bad times for the Jews? The temple has been destroyed. The Hadrianic persecutions were awful. Jews were not allowed to live in Jerusalem for 300 years. After the Churban, they could. But after the Bar Kokhba revolt, Jerusalem was changed into a pagan city called Aelia Capitolina. It was made a temple to Jupiter, the Avodah Zarah, the chief god of the Romans. And Jews were not allowed to live in that city for more than 200 years. Okay, it was the only time in Jerusalem's history since David HaMelech that, well, maybe also the 19 years from 48 to 67, plus those, that Yerushalayim didn't have Jews in it. 48 to 67 also, there were no Jews. Although some say there were hidden Jews, but you know, we don't really know. Okay, so the way Rashi explains it though, right in Rav Yehuda HaNasi's time, there was a little avenue of peace because there was an emperor who was very benign and looked at the Jews in a positive way. Some people connected to the emperor Marcus Aurelius. If you remember your Roman history, I remember it very vaguely, but Marcus Aurelius was a philosopher king, and he was someone who was benign. And that is why Rebbe decided to write the Mishnah down, because you're not supposed to write the oral law. But he said, this is a time when we still remember things. This is a time when we still have sages who were not yet murdered. Who knows who the next emperor is going to be? Let's take advantage of the respite that we have. That is actually giving you a little flesh on the bones of why the Mishnah was written down when it was written down. Because things were very bad, but there was a brief oasis of tranquility. Rav Yehuda HaNasi says, let's get it down while we can. Okay, now why am I bringing this in? Rav Yehuda HaNasi was not only the head of the Sanhedrin, but he was also the political leader of the Jewish population in Eretz Israel. So as a result, he had frequent occasion to talk to the emperors of Rome, as well as the Roman provincial governor. Right? What was the Roman capital of Israel? It was not Jerusalem. And you know, if you wanted to talk to the Roman governor of Palestine, as it was called, what city would you go to? You would go to Caesarea. That's why it's called Caesarea. It's named after Caesar. The Romans didn't want Jerusalem as their capital because there are too many Jews. they weren't comfortable with a lot of Jews because, Jews didn't like the Romans very much. So the Romans located their government in a city that had virtually no Jews. It was just a Roman city. And that's Caesarea. Now Caesarea has all sorts of Jewish musical concerts all the time. Shweki always goes to Caesarea and the like. Now, it is said that before every meeting with the Roman officials, Rav Yehuda HaNasi would always study Parshas Vayishlach. Because since the Romans are the descendants of Esav, this is how he wanted to learn how you deal with the Umos HaOlam. Right? So all I'm showing you from all of these chazals is that there are chazals that look at Yaakov's behavior as mistaken and erroneous, and there are chazals that look at Yaakov's behavior as the model for how you have diplomacy with the Umos HaOlam, that you try to be nice and peace-loving, but you be ready for war. Okay? Now, let me just mention one other thought about this. That is, what are the three steps again? Gift-giving, which means be nice and try to make peace. Number two, be ready for war, if that becomes necessary. And number three, daven to Hashem, that He should bless your efforts with success, because without those prayers, you for sure are not going to be successful. So I want to point out that some commentaries say that this could be extrapolated as a general lesson for how we deal with the secular world. We have a secular culture. Today, of course, you have Islamic fundamentalist culture, which is a different challenge. But let's talk for today not about the challenge of Islamic fanaticism. Let's talk about the challenge of Western civilization. Now, by and large, the challenge we face with Western civilization is not one of physical survival, meaning American culture is not trying to murder you physically, at least at this point. But you're dealing with spiritual challenges. Okay, unlike, let's say, the challenge of Islam, which is quite literally a physical survival issue, our issue of secular culture is a spiritual issue, which is even worse, but it is a spiritual issue. So how do I deal with the secularism and decadence of the world? So there are two different ways you can deal with it. One is wage war against it. Now, I don't mean, this is a metaphorical use of the word war, I don't mean weapons, but wage war is the attitude, I don't want secular culture to have any inroads in my life. I wage war against it as an enemy. No internet, no computer, no secular books, no secular music. Meaning that's called waging war. Waging war is when you simply say, I will not allow any of that to impact on my life and on my family. I will create a ghetto of the mind, so to speak, in which none of this treif comes in. That is one approach, and that's sometimes a necessary approach. There is another approach. That's gift-giving. That means I want to embrace what modernity has to offer, just as Chazal have a statement that if somebody tells you there is wisdom among the nations, you believe them. There's no Torah, but there's wisdom, there is insight, there's understanding. One should borrow from it. Now, we normally perceive of these as opposite approaches. Maybe you'll talk about the difference between Haredi and modern Orthodox, whatever you want to call it. There is a shita in Klal Yisrael that says wage war against the secular, and there is a shita in Klal Yisrael that says let us embrace the secular. What you learn from Yaakov is that this is not a binary choice. It's not this and not that, or this and not that, but rather Yaakov is doing both at the same time. Now that's very interesting, because what that is telling you is this. It is relatively easy to say everything outside of the Beis Medrash is no good and worthless. And it's even easier to say, I'm open to everything. But true wisdom is not living in a pure either-or mentality. Pure wisdom is having the insight to be able to say there are some things that are good and useful and some things that are evil and decadent. Now I understand if a person says, maybe we should all say this, that I'm not good enough, I'm not holy enough, I'm not bright enough, I'm not wise enough to be able to make these discriminations, so I just got to say no to everything. And that may be the right choice for a person. But the thing I want to show you from Yaakov is, it may be the right choice, but that's in the nature of the lesser of two evils. Meaning to say, it's not the optimal choice. It's the lesser of two evils, because if opening myself up to everything is going to destroy me, then I got to close myself to everything. But the Adam HaShalem would somehow find a way to bring in the beauty and the knowledge of even the secular world and be able to incorporate it and integrate it into their Torah. That is the deep meaning, symbolically, of why Yaakov combines warmongering with gift-giving, as if to suggest that in our confrontation with the secular, there is both the aspect of war, can't let it in, and the aspect of bringing it in. And one has to know. And that is where the third component is so critical. It is only through tefillah, prayer, submission to God, that you will get the insight to be able to make that difference. Otherwise, you'll be a victim of your own prejudices or your own likes or dislikes, and that's going to lead you astray. But when you connect to Hashem, He will give you the wisdom. And so again, this is a symbolic understanding of Yaakov's three steps, but I think it's a relevant one. As I say, I think we can certainly understand someone who says, I don't want to have any connection to that secular world, because it'll corrupt me, corrupt my children. And again, that may be a lot better than the alternative, but it is still the second best choice. It is not the highest level. And you see this in the Shemoneh Esrei itself. Motzei Shabbos, the first Amida after Shabbos, we say Havdalah in the Shemoneh Esrei. Right? Havdalah, Tachan Antanu, that God separates between the holy and the profane. And what bracha does that appear in? That's the bracha asking Hashem for knowledge. So the Gemara in Bracha says, why don't we put that in the bracha of knowledge? So it says, because without knowledge, you can't discriminate, you can't differentiate. The essence of knowledge, wisdom, is the ability to look at something and say, this part is good, and this part is bad. If your reactions are simply totally no good, totally good, you're not wise. Wisdom is the faculty of discrimination. In a positive way. In other words, the ability to see different nuances. Right? So when people say, okay, I don't want to get into too many examples because I may get in trouble with, I don't want to contradict other people, and hopefully I'm not, but you know, can you read secular books? You know, that's not a meaningful question, actually. Because, you can't say all secular books are bad or all secular books are good. I mean, those are two false statements. Right? One has to be able to discriminate what is good, what is bad, what is proper, what is not proper, what contributes to my relationship to Hashem, and what doesn't. You know, the great Rav Volba, I think you learned Ali Shore. He was a great, great Baal Musar, a very, very great tzaddik. When he was a young man, during World War II, he was, Baruch Hashem, he was able to be in Switzerland, which was a neutral zone. But he took classes and he worked with Jean Piaget. Have you heard of Jean Piaget? Jean Piaget, a non-Jew, was the world's greatest child psychologist. To this day, Piaget is considered, not alive anymore, but he's considered to be the Gadol Hador in the moral development of children, how children develop their moral intuitions and the like. And Rav Volba, who was a Baal Musar, spent a lot of time with John Piaget learning the secular understandings of child development. Now, why was he interested in doing it? He wasn't interested in getting a job as a psychologist when he came to Israel, but he basically said, if I am a person that is involved with training, helping young men to develop their midos and develop their character and develop their insight, I want to understand the process in terms of the science and everything else. Now, obviously, it has to be filtered through Torah, but he didn't have the attitude, Piaget is a goy, what does he have to teach me? Rather, he understood that this was a chachma by goyim. And he took that chachma, and he was able to use it in his avodas Hashem. Okay, and that's really a mapteach for all of us. And I would suggest that this is merumaz in the fact that Yaakov combines war and gift-giving and prayer in terms of how you relate to secular culture as a whole. But again, as I say, it takes a while to be wise, and indeed there's no guarantee we'll ever reach that, but at least as a goal, one should be able to try to understand there's good and there's bad, and how do I factor it out in the life. Okay, Mr. Ray Wasserman is coming at 12:30, so if you have a good day. Yeah.
Is it, you're saying it's wrong to say that something's totally bad? Or something's totally good?
Well, it depends. In other words, in an aggregate thing, meaning like this. I mean, I'm confident to say all pornographic books are bad. There are things I will say are all bad, but what I'm saying is, in larger categories, like secular, you have to break it down. Once you break it down into smaller units, yeah, there may be smaller units that are clearly destructive.
That's not to say that you can't learn something out of saying pornographic books are all bad.
Well, okay. In other words, I would agree with you. Even things that are all bad may have something valuable in them, but at some point, the loss is so much greater than the gain that, you got to drop it. I'm motivated to that. But the internet is a good example. Is internet bad? Internet has many, many awful, bad things. There is stuff that's good on it, too. Now, how does a person make a decision? It's a hard decision. But the point basically is, if a person, for example, has an addiction either to bad stuff on the internet or even to wasting time on the internet. Now, it doesn't have to be pornography, just wasting time. Then you got to decide, hey, I'm not going to take advantage of the good because the bad is too destructive. But there may be another personality who doesn't have those particular Yetzer Haras, in which this may be a good thing. Right? So you can't, in things like this, you can't just say all bad or all good. You got to look at the good and the bad, and then make a judgment. How is it affecting you? And people may come up with different answers. So in a lot of these questions, it is not one answer for everybody, but each individual has to grapple with it. So even within a Yiddishkeit that has so many common mitzvahs, common rules, there's a great deal of individualism that a person has in their avodas Hashem. It's not a one size fit all type of approach to things. Okay, you'll take care.